Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. Today's program is another in my Health Challenges series. My guest is Christina Crosby. Crosby is a graduate of Swarthmore College and Brown University, where she received her PhD in English. She is currently a professor in the English and Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies departments of Wesleyan University. In October 2003, at the age of 50, she broke her neck in a bicycle accident and instantly became paraplegic. She has written a truly awe-inspiring memoir about her experience called A Body Undone, Living On After Great Pain. It was published in March of this year by NYU Press, and I'm speaking to Christina Crosby by phone from her location in Connecticut. Christina Crosby, thank you so much for joining us. Now, I want to begin where you begin in your book. On October 1st, 2003, you were several miles into a 17-mile bicycle ride when a branch got caught in your tire spoke, and it changed your life forever. Tell us about what happened.
It was a catastrophic accident. That's actually a technical term that's used by insurance companies to name accidents that profoundly reorder your life. And that accident reordered my life because it profoundly reordered my body. I broke my neck, mm-hmm. and I smashed my face. And recovering from those injuries took a while, and rehabbing even longer.
Yeah, you were a month in the hospital, 4 months in rehab, and then you had 1.5 years of physical and occupational therapy. Do you remember much from that whole, you know, almost 2 year period?
Well, I don't remember much of anything from the acute care hospital. I was lifted by helicopter to Hartford Hospital, and I think that early intervention did much to help me. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall anything really from that time. But by the time I get to the rehab hospital, my memories are pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it is still quite vivid to me.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet. So are you totally paraplegic even 13 years after this happened?
Well, I'm completely paraplegic, which means that my legs have no functional strength at all. I can wiggle my toes and move my left leg a little bit, but it doesn't do me any good. So my legs are paralyzed. My torso is largely paralyzed, not completely, but that's really crucial because it means I can't sit up unless I'm leaning on something or held up by something. Otherwise, I just flop over. Mm-hmm. And my arms, I gained a lot of range of motion and some functional strength. My hands, which for a long time were just sort of curled into loose fists, are now quasi-functional. I have no fine motor control, but I'm holding the telephone, for example.
Wow, that's quite something, actually.
Yes, it is. It means that the injury was what's called incomplete. So the spinal cord was not severed, and some signals still go through. I mean, from the beginning, I had sensation all over my body. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I can pretty much flex any muscle. It just does me no good. It's kind of taunting.
Now, Christina, you know, the thing that interested me about what you talked about in your book is many people think of paralysis as having no feeling in your body, and you mm-hmm. describe this unbearable nerve pain and feeling yeah. like your skeleton is on fire. And to tell us more about that, I didn't know this.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the damage was to my central nervous system, and what I didn't understand then, although some of my friends seem to think I should have, I did not understand that nerve conduction is, in fact, electrical, that ions pass down the axons of a neuron and initiate the release of neurotransmitters, et cetera. All this happens at instantaneous speeds, millions, billions of times all through our bodies. And the damage to the central nervous system, in my case, produced neuropathic pain. So it's like being plugged in to a socket. Not that I'm being shocked, but that there's a buzzing throughout my entire body. Mm. And sometimes it seems to concentrate itself more under my skin, but mostly it suffuses the tissues. It's a bad pain and is largely abated by medication now, plus my whole system has settled down from the terrible shock it got.
Wow. God. So you're still experiencing that. You also talked about leg jerks and spasms and inability to sleep, but you've taken care of that with medication, I assume.
Yes, largely. It's very odd. Now and then I will wake at night, and it happened just the other night. I just felt horrible.
Mm.
You know, I really felt like I was lit up. And my lover, Janet, asked me if I wanted to take some Valium, which can settle those sensations down. It certainly can settle down spasticity.
Mm-hmm.
And I demurred simply because when I take Valium or when I take any extra medication, I become so sleepy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good for falling asleep, but... No, I'm on opiates. I'm on a drug called Lyrica that's really the drug that physicians now throw against the wall and hope that it covers something. It's used for all kinds of neuropathic pain and for epilepsy.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think they're still trying to experiment in how to help people with pain like yours?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, pain is notoriously difficult to treat, notoriously difficult to describe or measure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fact of life that produces metaphor, mm-hmm. right? I say I'm buzzing like electricity. Well, okay, except that it's not exactly like being plugged into a socket. It's just that that's the closest I can get to describing it.
Yeah. You fold in a lot of poetry in this memoir. Tell us about what poetry means to you. Has it been something that you've attached to after this catastrophe, or were you always into poetry?
Well, no, I really was not always into poetry. Part of it was just the fact that a lyric poem is possible to quote in its entirety. I really can't quote those Victorian novels that I teach.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I can't just put Middlemarch into my book. But I can put a poem by Emily Dickinson in the book, which is, in fact, the first text anyone encounters. It's mm-hmm. the epigraph to the entire book, and, in fact, it's silently quoted in the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
The subtitle is Living on After Great Pain, and the phrase after great pain is the first phrase in a famous poem written by Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, yeah, I actually knew that poem when I encountered it. Now we can't talk about your story without mentioning your brother, Jeff. He was just 1 year older. You thought of him as a kind of twin when you guys were growing up. You competed with him. You know, you didn't think of yourself as a girl, but you guys were both twin boys almost. Played rough and tumble games. Tell us about him, and then we'll talk about what happened.
Well, I was a tomboy. It was the 1950s. That was a term that was used for a girl that did not do femininity. And I didn't do femininity. I didn't think of myself as a boy, but I played boys' games with my brother. So we played all conceivable sports together. You name a sport, we played it,
mm-hmm.
except for ice hockey. But we played bicycle polo. You know, we made up a game. And they were all games of speed and strength and skill. And we were very evenly matched. So we had a super competitive childhood, competed all the time. And that stopped with junior high, because junior high really is the full theater for enforcing gender.
Absolutely.
But that early play with Jeff continued to shape our relationship. And then suddenly he was diagnosed with MS. He was diagnosed with MS in his late 20s, and the competition obviously stopped. I mean, mm-hmm. I can remember the last time we played one-on-one basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just stopped.
And
he, you know, he was slowly paralyzed over the course of his life.
Yeah, and you watched him decline, and you couldn't believe what you were watching. The way you describe it in your book is amazing.
Yeah, it was very hard because he was obviously a very athletically gifted guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he led a very embodied life, as I did. I mean, one of the real tragedies for me is that I was so self-conscious about the pleasures that my body afforded me.
Mm-hmm.
And so was he. So watching him slowly become completely paralyzed. So by his 50s, he had to retire, but he was 49, I think. And then 8 years later, he's dead. And
yeah.
It's really that tragedy that was the surplus of grief. I just couldn't continue working as I had been working on 19th century topics.
Yeah, and you were intimately involved in his last years, too. You were, to me, you were an incredibly compassionate sister. I was amazed by your account.
Yeah, before I got hurt, when I visited, I would help him so that we could have time by ourselves without having an aide interrupt us. And I got to handle his body. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was hard for me in the hospital was I was just undone with the thought that suddenly all that I had done for him would have to be done for me.
I know.
I knew way too much. It was really, really, really hard.
God, it's an unbelievable story, Christina. I mean, it's a haunting story because you kept talking in the book about how you thought you guys were twins, and then
yeah,
you both became paraplegic. That's just not fair as a twist of fate, right?
Yeah, and in fact, the technical diagnosis is quadriplegic, which is significant paralysis in all four limbs, which I do have. And as I say, by the time his life ended, he really was completely paralyzed. He could move his head.
God, that is so haunting. Now, tell us about the help and care that you were able to get and absolutely needed to get after this accident. Friends, family, your personal care attendant, Donna, tell us about these people and how you never expected that you would need so much help and how much incredible help they gave you.
It was remarkable. We were fed for 2 years, two full years. It's put me a little bit off lasagna, but other than that,
yeah, you talk about
people
that.
Dropped off their casseroles and their soups and their food for us on the back porch, and we turned it around so that there was always a huge pile of Tupperware out there. We needed that help because I couldn't do anything, and Janet was completely hurt. She didn't cook.
Yeah.
And she now does. I mean, it's been a long retrofitting of both our lives, but we needed the help. I mean, she works in New York City. She's a professor at Barnard. I'm a professor in Central Connecticut in Middletown.
Mm-hmm.
So she was with me for both of the first semester. I got hurt in October, so the fall semester she was on leave. In the spring semester, she actually taught up here. So she was able to be with me here in Middletown, but then she had to go back to work. And when she went back to work, I still couldn't turn over in bed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Crosby. We're doing a health challenges interview, and we're talking about her memoir called A Body Undone, Living On After Great Pain. It recounts her fateful day in 2003 when she had a bicycle accident and became paraplegic. Now, Christina, let's continue this talk about how much help you needed, how much help Janet needed. Go ahead and continue.
Well, I'll try to illustrate it with two things. One, when I first came home, I could do nothing. And when I say nothing, I do mean that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was sitting in my chair, I could be seated if I were held up. If I were sitting in my chair, I couldn't tip myself from side to side. So people had to come and tip me from side to side to relieve the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So that I wouldn't get pressure sores. That's a degree of helplessness that's really quite profound.
Yes.
And caring for me took the care of so many. It continues to take the care of Donna, who is a person whom I pay directly. I'm so fortunate. I mean, money makes all the difference in the world, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're paralyzed, it's even more the case because the help is so very intimate. The handling of my body is something that she's now done for over a decade. And
mm-hmm.
we have grown quite close in consequence.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you talk about the politics of personal care aides and, you know, how they're not well paid. And to talk to us a little bit about how you feel about that at this point.
Well, I'll just give you a simple statistic out of the New York Times. 51% of people who work as health aides live in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
That means they're below the poverty line. which is a joke. It's very hard to live at or below the poverty line.
Yeah.
So everybody who works that kind of job has two jobs. And that was really my salvation because I met Donna in the hospital. She was a CNA, and she worked the second shift, which meant that the morning was open. And she agreed to come and help me from 8 till 12:30 every day. And she still does that work. So she had to have two jobs to pay the rent, to pay the bills, just to get by. The work was just relentless.
Oh, yeah.
It really is relentless. And it's because the pay is so bad. It really is scandalous. And the pay is so bad because personal care, you know, the labors of love are women's work.
Yeah.
And if they're paid work, they're black women's work. That goes back so far in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. I know.
And it means that everybody who does that work is terribly underpaid. So we have a complicated relationship, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
She cares for me. I care for her very deeply. I love her. She loves me. But I pay her. So it's complicated.
Yeah.
You know, she needs the money. I need the care. I'm very, very glad we have each other.
Yeah.
But it's not an equal relationship by any stretch of the imagination, although it's a very loving one.
Yeah, you talk a lot about it in your book. It's very moving the way you talk about her. Now, I want to move on to there's a quote from your memoir, and this is it. It says, "I find myself repeatedly, daily, relentlessly, and wearyingly horrified by the elsewhere of spinal cord injury." So tell us what you mean by elsewhere.
Well, I found myself writing the book because it is so difficult to know what happens to a body after spinal cord injury, the kinds of deficits that someone will suffer, the sorts of invisible pains that can course through my body. And when I work half time now,
mm-hmm.
when I roll into the classroom and start teaching, I'm a professor. But it took so much labor, including a tremendous amount of emotional labor on my part, to get myself every day into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to bear witness to that work. It's work I do. It's work Janet does. It's work Donna does. It's work that people at school do help me with. I found myself on the floor of the bathroom once.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and my friend came down from upstairs, and someone from food service who was in the building came and. She used to work as a CNA, thank God, and they just picked me up and put me back in the chair. But, you know, that's an extreme example. But I do need help.
Mm-hmm.
And I want people to understand.
Yeah. It must be such a bizarre thing for you to have to go through. And it's got to be a kind of loneliness for you, even though you have all these people surrounding you,
yeah.
right? Isn't that what the elsewhere meant? That's what I picked up, what that meant.
Yeah, no, you're right about that, and I'm glad that you bring us back to that fact. Yes, the elsewhere is somewhere that I feel alone in, and that's because of the emotional labor that I alluded to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I was in the hospital, I often wished that I had died in the accident because my life was so hard. I was suffering so much. And yet, I was determined I never refused therapy. I did all the therapy that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. I did that in order to be in relation first to Janet,
mm-hmm.
but then to the world of people that I care about. And yet, I am alone because No one can see the neurological pain,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's with me always. It acts as a kind of screen sometimes. You know, it just removes me from the world that everyone else is living in.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, it is just, it's very demanding being with somebody who is quadriplegic.
Yeah.
I mean, I need so much help. And when we go, it's very hard to go out. You know, you have to call ahead and make sure the restaurant is accessible, et cetera, et cetera. So it's that otherness. It's that, it's the fact that no one, including Janet, can understand this interior experience, which I did my best to put into words, because I need that to be seen. I think we all need to be seen, be
mm-hmm.
recognized
mm-hmm.
by another in order to have any sense of selfhood at all.
Yeah, well, your memoirs...
And yet I'm unrecognizable.
Are you saying you're unrecognizable to yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, 50 years.
I know.
You know, I lived 50 years before I broke my neck. There are so many different ways that people come to the various incapacities that the world makes disabling. So many ways. And the struggle for disability rights, the right to access to public life, is one that is ongoing. Everybody needs to be unified.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. You must be totally and unexpectedly on a personal, you know, relationship basis with the Americans with Disabilities Act, which still needs a lot of work.
Yes, absolutely. I would not be at work if it were not for that act. I would not be at work if it hadn't been for people dumping themselves out of their wheelchairs and pulling themselves up the steps of the Capitol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
The Deaf President Matt Now movement down at Gallaudet.
Yep. And then
that work is ongoing.
Yeah, yeah. 30-plus years, and we're still trying to... Even in our town here in Ithaca, I know people with disabilities who are in wheelchairs. They have to fight to get into certain buildings. Things are blocked. There is access, and then people forget and put stuff in front of it. And
Yeah.
It's just crazy. Now, do you must find, and I've talked to other people about that, you must find that the world looks at you differently too, right? I mean, is that one of the blockades for being able to feel normal in the world in some aspect?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, 50 years one way and then suddenly another. I was really happy with Janet when I got hurt. One of the great griefs of my life is losing the joy that came with shared physical activity like ocean kayaking.
Mm-hmm.
My sexual sensation is dull. I can't have an orgasm. I mean, that's a huge loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But more on a more daily level, I can't dress the way I liked dressing. I can't produce the same body, I can't be the same person
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we are what we put on to some extent, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get dressed up. I would get dressed up in leather pants and a velvet jacket and feel very, very sporting.
Yeah, yeah. I love it.
You know, you step out with that good pair of cowboy boots, you know, life is good.
Yeah.
And that's done. You know, that's done. When people look at me, the first thing they see is the chair. Because when you glance at somebody, that's you get a gestalt. You get a sort of total image without seeing details. And that's what they see.
Mm-hmm.
And because I have short hair and I'm dressed all in black and the chair is black, you know, I look like a guy to most people when they look at me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a butch lesbian, so that's not a terrible insult. by any means, but it's not produced by the same look that I had before.
Or the same intent, right?
Yes, or the same intent, exactly.
Yeah.
More to the point.
Yeah. Gosh, you know, Christina, we are almost out of time. I just want to end with this note that you have attributed writing as creating a path to the life you live now. To tell us a little bit about that. You write via voice activation software. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's rather incomprehensibly called Dragon, naturally speaking. Seems to be a contradiction in terms all the way around, but that's the name of the software. And it allows me to do my work. So, you know, that accommodation that is allowed, that's supported by the university.
Mm-hmm.
And I need that support because it's a technical thing that breaks down now and then. So I am able to continue, but under such different circumstances, it's what I've tried to represent in the book,
mm-hmm.
how it's possible to continue working and yet work in such a different way.
Yeah, but it's kept you, you know, connected to the world in so many ways. So I'm so glad that you were able to do it, you know.
Thank you. And the writing, you know, that's what I had, right? I study literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I had language and literature to help me. And I had all of the thinking about embodiment that feminist theory
mm-hmm.
had given me over decades of reading and thinking. All of that is in the deep background of the book
mm-hmm.
and supports it. It's the intellectual structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that I still have access to.
Yeah.
I still have access to intellectual work,
mm-hmm.
even though I no longer handle paper. You know, much of it is digital.
Yeah.
I still can read books, but I can't handle them the way I did.
Yeah. Well, we are so lucky that you wrote this book. It's really an amazing book. I hope my listeners will go out and read it. Christina, do you have any contact information that people can get in touch with you through the book? Listeners would like to probably get in touch with you.
Well, if you wish to get in touch with me, my email is straightforward. It's C. Crosby at Wesleyan, Wesley, and then A-N,
mm-hmm.
Wesleyan.edu. That will reach me. That's the most effective way to reach me.
Okay. Well, Christina Crosby, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called A Body Undone, Living On After Great Pain. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your bravery in laying out this terrible tragedy that you're still living through. Thank you, Christina.
Tisha, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience. Thanks much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.